The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the Morning Show comes from Carthage College, which launched an RN to BSN program in January. Practicing nurses with an associate degree can complete a Bachelor of Science in Nursing in 16 months, taking a mix of online and on-campus courses. For more information, go to carthage.edu/BSN. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Over the last few months, I have spent a fair amount of time going through plastic bins of old cassette tapes in search of interesting morning show interviews from the past that are worthy of rebroadcast. And not long ago, I came across an interview that, frankly, I had forgotten all about, but which I think is a real gem and worth hearing again. It's with gifted writer Kelly Corrigan, who has given the world four different books, including Lift and Glitter and Glue, both about the experience of being a mom, as well as a book called Tell Me More, stories about the 12 hardest things I'm having to say. But this interview from 2008 concerns her memoir, The Middle Place, which deals largely, although not exclusively, with her experience with breast cancer. I want to mention that Kelly Corrigan is also responsible for an absolutely wonderful podcast called Kelly Corrigan Wonders, in which she will take on a wide array of different topics, and she does so with special guests, and not just with isolated single episodes, but with series in which she can really explore a topic with some depth. I think my favorite thus far is a 5-part series called How to Make the Most of Family Life, which she did with Anna Sale and Anna Quindlen. There's also a very fine 10-part series titled How Change Really Happens. Again, that podcast is titled Kelly Corrigan Wonders, and I highly recommend it. On to the interview now from 2008 about her memoir called The Middle Place. I do want to alert you to the fact that the first couple minutes of this interview are not the best sound quality, but the quality does improve after that, and so I hope you will bear with me and enjoy this interview in its entirety. Here it is with Kelly Corrigan. One of my favorite things about the book is the title. I wonder if you would explain what you mean by The Middle Place. It's certainly a central focus of this story.
Yeah. You know, The Middle Place refers to that sliver of time when parenthood and childhood overlap. In other words, I sort of picture it like a Venn diagram where there's just my family of origin and then my maid family, and I'm the only member of both sets. And in that middle place, I think there's a lot of questions about how to prioritize and also where you're driving the core of your identity. So the first line of The Middle Place is, the thing you need to know about me is that I'm George Corrigan's daughter. And, you know, that's really how I have thought of myself for most of my life. And it's only just recently that I'm starting to shift into thinking of myself more as Georgia and Claire's mom, or Edward's wife, or just me.
In fact, not to jump ahead, but at one point in the book, there's kind of an interesting experience where you are actually hoping that you and your husband and daughters will move to someplace closer to where you grew up and will be closer to your parents. And
several things sort of conspire to make that not possible. And in talking about this with your husband and how hard to push for this move nonetheless to occur, he actually says something pretty insightful at that moment in time. Tell our listeners what I'm talking about, because I think a lot of us, one way or another, find ourselves in sort of exactly the same place or predicament.
Yeah, I mean, my whole generation, I would say half of us are far from home. And so I know lots and lots of people at readings come up to me and say, oh, I struggle with this all the time. What am I doing living so far from my parents, especially as they get older and that sort of thing. But I was really thinking not so much about caring for them, but more just being with them during this time when my kids are young and they're wild about their grandparents. And I was sort of imagining what life could be like there for us, and Edward palling around with my dad and us running errands together and that sort of thing. And it was all triggered by this job opportunity that we thought Edward was going to get this offer. And, you know, in the time that it took for him to not get the offer, I had really started to attach to the idea of moving home. And so when this letter came through that said they had picked someone else, you know, I was already kind of half-packed in my mind. And he said, you know, as much as you want to be there with them, this is your life, like, we're your life. This is your future. And he was sort of looking at me and the girls who were so young. They were in little baby baskets on the floor. And, you know, it was just one of those moments where it's like, right, like, that's what I'm doing. I'm transitioning from that life to this life. And I might be dragging my feet a little bit. And then, you know, the cancer thing comes in to the story only because it was a crisis. And I think you learn a lot about yourself when you're in a crisis and you see exactly who you turn to. And I turned home. I turned to my parents. And I'm not sure that I realized that I was still so dependent on them emotionally and maybe even in other ways. I mean, they really, in a very practical sense, they made that whole fall when I was in chemo. They really made it work. And So I think that was a big wake-up call, that although I was independent enough to move across the country and vote Democrat when they're all Republicans and get a tattoo and, you know, and be my own girl in many ways, you know, when a doctor calls and tells you you've got a runaway case of breast cancer and you're going to be in chemotherapy in a week, what do you do? And I called home.
Yeah, calling home is part of what we do. Before we get to the story of cancer, I want to read a moment where we are returning to this theme of the middle place. I think you say this so well at the opening of chapter 4. You write, "It is one thing to be a man's wife, quite another to be the mother of his children. In fact, once you become a mother, being a wife seems like a game you once played or a self-help book you were overly impressed with as a teenager that on second reading is puffy with common ideas. This was one of many things I had learned since crossing over into the middle place, that sliver of time when childhood and parenthood overlap. One day you're cheering your daughter through a swimming lesson or giving her a pat for crossing the monkey bars or reminding her to say please, and the next you're bragging to your parents about your newest trick, a sweet potato recipe, a raise at work, a fix for your aunt problem. It's a giant Venn diagram where you are the only member of both sets. The middle place is also hallmarked by endless, irresistible, often exasperating comparisons between your family of origin and the family you've made. My parents would never let us talk to them like that. My mom always insisted that we eat dinner together. My dad spanked us with a wooden spoon all the time, and we're fine. Thanks to these filial imprints, Edward and I have caught ourselves fighting over such minutia as how to cook pasta, set a timer, or do a taste test. I mean, in a sense, although that's not the primary focus of your book, in some respects, that's such a universal theme you are touching on there. In a sense, the blending of families that has nothing to do with that kind of classic Brady Bunch scenario.
Right,
but in
right.
fact, anybody who comes from a family and then starts their own family is doing their own version of this family blending, which can be so interesting and complicated.
Yeah, and it's hard to, if for a while there, you don't even realize you're doing it. Like, you would say these declarative sentences, like, that's not how you scramble eggs. And it takes you, like, 3 years to realize that that's not how your family scrambles eggs.
But there are other families with their means of scrambling eggs.
I mean, and it's just everything. That's not how you sell a car. That's not how you buy a house. That's not how you invest your money. You know, that's not how you act at a cocktail party. I mean, you know, the scale of things is changing all the time, but you're always bumping up against, this is the way I thought it was done, and now I'm realizing that this is just the way we did it. And I have to decide whether I want to continue doing it that way or whether we should make up a new way.
This might
be worst of all, if I want to switch to your family's way. There's so much pride, you know. It's like, well, God, I'm not going to do it the way they do it.
And you are justifiably proud of who you come from. And in particular, I mean, radiating off of nearly every page of this book is your adoration for your father. I mean, you certainly love your mother as well, but your father emerges from this story as someone in many respects both ordinary, down to earth, and larger than life. Just tell our listeners what you think will be most helpful for them to know about your father, George Corrigan.
Well, you know, he's a Catholic. That's the first thing. He's a huge athlete. So he loves lacrosse and squash and tennis and golf and, you know, going on long walks and whatever he can get into. But most of all, he loves people. So he's just one of those connectors where you're just talking to him for a few minutes and it just makes you feel like he's never met anybody quite as smart or quite as funny or quite as beautiful as you. And he does that for everyone. It's not particular to me necessarily, which is a remarkable thing. I think that it could have gone awry had all of that goodness been reserved for one person, but it's just spilling out of him all the time, wherever he is, at the gas station, at the dry cleaners, at the farmer's market. The other thing about him that's really interesting to me is that he's a Corrigan, and there's a really big clan behind him. He's one of six kids. They're all really in touch with each other. They all come to my readings. You know, they drive 2 hours to watch me do another reading. They've each sold hundreds of books from their living room. I mean, they're just people who take the family thing really seriously, and it comes really naturally to them. And, I mean, I remember riding on 95 once with my dad and saying, like, who's your best friend? And he said, I don't know, probably anybody with the last name Corrigan. And thinking, like, that's really true for him. That's really what grounds him. Catholic Church and the Corrigans. And there's a lot of crossover there.
Your father is certainly the more central of the two parents in this book, partly because, of course, you and he directly share this common trial of cancer.
I think the reason he comes up is because we all thought that this last diagnosis was going to kill him. And it was the first time that I internalized the idea that someday these people that I've been counting on will not be here, no matter what happens to me, no matter what doctor calls me and gives me what awful diagnosis, no matter what happens to my marriage or my house or my children. Like, there will be a time when I'll just have to figure it out myself. And that was the thesis of the book, is you're not really an adult. You're not really all the way grown up until you're living in the world without those people.
And the unique thing which they can give to you.
Which is their love. I mean, nobody loves you like a parent loves you, hopefully. I mean, I know that not everybody has great parents, or parents that, you know, are passionately attached to them, but nobody cares about you and your day like your parents do. I mean, your husband doesn't and your kids don't. I mean, nobody's interested in your tummy ache or how you bought some new sheets. Or how you recovered something. I mean, they're just not. Like, there's only one person and two people in the whole world that are that interested, you know, that are following you, that for whom you are central. And I know that both ways now. I know it because I am that person to my parents, and I know it because my children are that person to me.
You write about this.
If it gets cancer, you know, it will, you know, it's the worst moment of your life.
You write so beautifully about this in talking about a friend of yours named Jen Camosa, who lost her mother 7 years ago. And this is what you write. When I called Jen to check on her, this is in the wake of her mother's death,
She told me that people were swarming around doing what people do, flowers, food, cards, calls, favors. She said just about everyone said something like, your mom had a good life, she had a lot of happiness, she was so uncomfortable, now she's at peace. Well, yeah, okay, good for your mom, but what about you? What about your peace, your comfort? Who's going to remember what you were for Halloween that year, or the name of your fifth grade teacher? Who's going to loan you money to buy your first house or cry when your baby is born? Who's going to sit in the front row of your play? And you go on to write, look, Mom, this is the scene where we get engaged. Oh, you're going to love this part. Look at me in my white dress, Dad. How about this one? Edward and Dad playing golf together. And in this next scene, we get pregnant. Hey, look, Dad, Edward reads Sports Illustrated cover to cover just like you. Isn't this a good play? Don't you love it? Wait, there's more. Edward gets promoted in the third act. Don't go yet. Georgia is going to kindergarten next year. Wait till you see her first swim meet, her tiger goggles. Please stay. We bought Claire tap shoes. This part's coming up. Claire plays the harmonica. She's applying to Yale. Don't leave. It gets so good. And what you're saying is that nobody would sit glued to their seat, drinking in every detail of this so-called play as it goes on, than would your own parents.
Yeah, I mean, there's barely even a separation. Like, I really feel on reflection that, like, for instance, there's a story, every other chapter in the book is a flashback to childhood. And they're there because the book needs comic relief, but also because there's some really interesting parallels between the things that happened in your childhood and the things that were happening to me that one year when both my dad and I were sick. And there's one chapter where this girl's really mean to me, persistently mean to me, in sixth grade. And it's really painful for my mom to watch it and not be able to help me. And she can't protect me, and she knows it, and she's learning it every single day when I come home and through the back door in tears. And later, you know, 20 years later, we're sitting out on the back deck having a glass of wine, and I said, so, you know, what was the worst year of your life? And she said, I don't know, sixth grade was pretty bad. And I said, oh, my God, me too. And she said, Kelly, not my sixth grade, your sixth grade. And it was, and I understand that. I really do. It's really painful to see somebody that you love in pain and have to accept the awful fact that no matter how much you would give for that person to be out of pain, there's nothing that you can do to stop it. And I know it. I know it from watching my kids now, and I know it from watching my dad that year when he was sick.
In that little exchange with your mom where you don't immediately even understand when she says sixth grade was bad, well, me too, not my sixth grade, Kelly, your sixth grade.
Yeah, well, I wasn't my mom yet.
Yeah,
so
and you asked why I asked, wondering if I had forgotten something terrible that had happened to her that year. And she replies, you'll see. When you're a mother and your kid's in pain and you can't stop it, it's hell. Absolute hell.
It is.
Those are powerful words about motherhood and what it really means.
Oh, I just found the letter in my daughter's room last night that was to a girl in her class that she was saying, you know, why are you so mean to me, blah, blah, blah. And I woke up in the middle of the night thinking about it.
We're speaking with Kelly Corrigan. We're talking about her New York Times bestseller, The Middle Place, which is just out in paperback. I find it intriguing, and it says something about how rich this book is, that we're almost 20 minutes into the interview, and we really have scarcely even tapped the topic of your cancer.
You're a good interviewer, I must say.
well, let's explore that now, of course, this awful reality which enters your life so unexpectedly. You are just 36 years old. Tell our listeners sort of how this first came to your attention.
You know, my kids were one and two, and Edward was away. And when he's away, we often we used to when they were little, and we all sit in there. We used to take a bath together, and so I was in the bath, and I was just went to wipe some soap from my eye, and I felt something just right under the skin in my breast, and. You know, and I kind of went cold for a second, and I thought, I definitely took it seriously. Like, I mean, I wouldn't say I knew right away, but I definitely thought that was not there. I mean, that is new, that is different, and that is hard. And I didn't touch it for a while, and then right towards the end of the bath, I just gently put my hand on it again, And then I just stood up, and it turns out that my OBGYN is a good friend of mine. So I called her at home. The girls were in their pajamas, and I said, hey, I just found something really weird, and would you mind if I zipped over and you could give it a feel? And she said, sure. So we went over in the car listening to an American Idol CD, and I laid down on her sofa and took my shirt off, and she gave me a breast exam, and she said, you know, it's hard, which is bad, but it's large, which is bad, but it's movable, which is good. And, you know, in people your age, they tend to be cysts, so let's just sign you up for a mammogram tomorrow. And so I went home and thought that maybe it was a cyst, and then I went to get a mammogram, and the guy said, it looks like an explosion. And I thought, oh, my God, here we go.
That doesn't sound good.
There's a part of me that's, I mean, I have had a really charmed life, and I know it. I mean, my parents are married. They're healthy. My brother, I like my brothers. They like me. We had a really fun time growing up, for the most part. I mean, you know, fought like cats and dogs, but on balance, we had a good time. And, you know, like a lot of things that could have gone wrong didn't go wrong. A lot of things that went wrong in my friends' lives did not go wrong in mine. I found my guy. I was able to get pregnant. My kids are healthy. I mean, that's a lot of the big stuff that's in place. And I know that, and I've always known that. And so when it happened, it was sort of like, okay, well, I certainly can't act like this isn't fair. You know, I mean, I owe the world one. I mean, there's no way that you're going to get through life without some bumps. And so if this is my bumps,
this was not, a chapter in the book of Job, in other words.
Yeah, no. And so I took it, you know, and on we went into chemotherapy and such. And actually, you know, as soon as I started getting better, which, you know, we could tell that the chemo was working about 6 weeks into it, it was getting softer and smaller. And, you know, then there's a really big silver lining, I think, to illness and crisis. I mean, I think there's a lot of intimacy that springs from that that you really can't get any other way, and I think it accelerates relationships, and it really helps you let go of a lot of stuff that's silly, you know. And so if you get better, I think that you're probably better off having been sick than not.
I want to ask you about what in a sense is a tiny little moment, but so interesting. This is right after you have paid this visit to Dr. White, who is the doctor who really takes a closer look and tells you that this mass looks like an explosion. Of course, that is a very alarming information. And as this mammogram,
I've been using that word with a 36-year-old. I just couldn't believe it.
Right. So you have gone out into the waiting room then to schedule this mammogram that will occur a few days later. You say, sitting there, explosion ringing in my ear. I long for Monday morning, when my great project was pulling together a birthday lunch, when everything was just as mundane as and unremarkable as it could be. You start to cry, and you feel people looking at you like the lady sitting two seats down, thin and tidy, and surprised when I tell her I am alone, that I'll be driving a car in a minute, heading home to relieve the babysitter, cook some mac and cheese for the girls. She offers to take me home or call a cab, but I move away from her, unable to stand the kindness. I think that is so interesting, because I think until you've sat in the place you were sitting, it's probably a little bit hard for onlookers to understand how one could be in a situation where you can't stand the kindness. Mm-hmm. Explain a little further what that moment felt like to you, and if you had similar moments through the course of this journey where kindness was something you probably needed, but probably in many moments, well, you were unable to accept it.
Well, that, I mean, you know, that felt like a really dangerous moment. Like, I felt like I was on the verge of some kind of breakdown, and I just did not want to have it with a total stranger. And I thought, you know what, if she goes to hug me, I'm going to break in two. I mean, I'm just going to wail. I can't tell you what kind of sounds are going to come out of me if somebody gives me a hug. You know that feeling where you're just afraid, you just don't want to, and people know, I mean, people say, don't even hug me. I don't want to have this all come tumbling out. And also, it's like you don't want to accept the fact that you might be so distraught that you can't drive yourself home. I mean, that's like a level of weakness that is alarming. I mean, that in and of itself would be alarming, because I sort of needed to prove to myself at that moment, okay, like, you can do this. You can get in the car and you can drive home and you can pay the babysitter. And you can pour some water in a pot and you can get the girl seated at the table, and you can do this. Like, you're going to have to keep moving here because you have children.
Mm.
And it's a real, you know, it's a time when you really feel, I mean, that's the responsibility of parenthood. Like, I feel this every time I even get a really bad cold. And I think, if I didn't have children, I would just lay in bed all day. That there's no sick days for moms. Like, you can't call in a babysitter because you have the flu. You just get up, and you take your kids to school, and then you come home and pass out. You set the alarm, and you go down there and pick them up, and you hand in their forms. And, you know, so it was one of those moments where it's like, you can't let this woman help you, because if she starts helping you, you might not ever be able to let her stop.
Hmm. You get home and end up kind of allowing a hug from this teenage babysitter when you can't keep this news in. I want you to tell our listeners about what happens that next morning. I think your husband's been out of town. Is that right?
Yeah.
So he is back, and that first night that you are in bed together after this, you know, really frightening thing has overtaken you.
Yeah.
Tell our listeners about that really tough conversation that the two of you end up having, and maybe what you learned from that, or what you hope readers will learn from that very early hard exchange between you and your husband.
Well, I have a lot of very strong opinions about how people should, how important it is for people to let other people help them when they're sick, and most especially their spouse or their partner or their closest friends. Those people really need to know what you want, and it's not a time to be a martyr or to be stoic. It's a time to let people love you through something. It makes the world go round. It enlarges them. It grows them as human beings, et cetera. So there's a whole speech I have on letting people love you through stuff, and that's what circusofcancer.org is all about. It's just trying to enable that relationship, you know, to flourish in a time of crisis. But to answer your specific question, you know, my husband is a man, and men, I find, typically, are really good at saying, I'm not going to pre-live this. I'm not going to pretend like you have cancer when you don't. You had a mammogram. It was bad. We're going to get a biopsy. That's what we're doing. That's all we're doing. Nothing has happened yet. And, you know, that's great for him. And it was definitely clear to me that possibly that was as much as he could handle. But that wasn't where I was. I mean, I was three steps down the road. And you know, I was there. I was in the mammogram, and I knew the guy's face, and I knew his expression, and I knew what that conversation looked like. And I had seen my own mammogram films. And not that I know how to read them, but this was so obvious that, you know, a two-year-old could have pointed it out. And so I was, you know, starting to live through it, and I was trying to think through what this was going to be like, and he just didn't want to go there. And then that made me feel really lonely and kind of crazy, and so I pushed a little, and then he kind of came clean that it wasn't that he hadn't thought about it. He had thought about it.
May I read this paragraph?
Sure.
These are the words of your husband when you really push to know what he's thinking and feeling. And he asks, Do you want to know what I think about this? Do you really want to know what I thought about on the plane ride home? He can barely talk. I thought about it all the way to the end and beyond. I thought if you died and someday I had to find another wife, my eyes widen, I would be so mad at her because she wouldn't be you. We have switched positions. I am wrapped around him now, and I thought that no one could touch those girls. No one deserves them. No one makes them who they are like you do. I think what's so interesting, many things are interesting and beautiful about that little exchange, but one of them is that, you know, even your own husband, whom you love and who loves you and who you know very well, that nonetheless, at that moment in time, you honestly didn't know what was in his mind and heart until he told you, which is really intriguing. It says a lot about how mysterious all of this can still be, even with those we are so close to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it just, I mean, there's a lot. You have to really, I'm learning now. I've only been married since 2000, so I still consider myself sort of new at it. But I find, especially now that life has returned to more mundane patterns, you have to really ask questions. Like just the other day, Edward made this sort of off-the-cuff comment. We were talking about someone that we know and love who's depressed, sort of clinically depressed, and Edward said, oh, you know, well, you know, it's just like when you get in a bad mood and then nothing seems good, like your whole life doesn't seem good. And I said, and I sort of held it for a couple hours, and then later I said, do you get in bad moods where nothing feels good? And, you know, you're trying to ask it in a way that they can answer it honestly. And he said, yeah, sometimes. And I said, so, like, how often a month would you say? And how much doesn't seem good? And, you know, like, you have to really keep your ears open, and you have to follow up on stuff with people, or else you could lose track of how they really feel about things, or worse, you could presume that you already know.
Mm.
Like, I think that's this mistake that people are making all the time. I mean, I am, anyway, especially with my kids, where I've kind of locked in, like, this is who Georgia is, this is who Claire is, and they're 5 and 7, and they're not who they are yet.
Mm-hmm.
And they might not even, you know, and then it's like going home when your brother thinks you're always the one who dot, dot, dot. And it's like, well, I used to do that, but I don't do that anymore. Like, I'm 41. I've changed.
Allowing people
so
to grow.
Hard.
Allowing people to grow is part of what this is about.
Yeah, and like blinking and cleaning your palate a little bit and then taking them in again fresh.
Hmm.
And it's hard to do. It's hard to do with your spouse and your kids and are the most important relationships. And it's, you can really get cocky, like, I know exactly what you're thinking.
Hmm.
And it's like, maybe you don't.
Hmm. You mentioned your website, circusofcancer.org, which is designed to help friends who have cancer be helpful to their friends, which, of course, is what they so desperately long to be and do. A slightly later chapter in the book, by this point you are undergoing treatment and so on, you say, at one point, needing a boost, I send out an email, tinkering with every sentence. It has to be upbeat so people won't worry too much, and funny so they won't be scared to write back. It's a big job being the first person your age to get cancer. I want you to talk about two facets there. First of all, that experience that you had, which was, of course, very different from your father's experience. I mean, where he had cancer at a time in life when many of his peers were dealing with either cancer or other things of sort of similar dimensions.
Like a funeral a week.
Yeah. Versus, of course, for you, this was in a sense, not that you were alone, but in terms of your peers, you were very much alone in this odyssey. But also the matter of crafting this email and of feeling like you were having to sort of walk a tightrope in terms of how serious, how funny to make it, how in what way it would be best for you to talk about this. And I suspect mm-hmm. that went beyond just those moments when you were writing emails, but even just talking to people.
Yeah.
I want to hear about that tightrope as well.
Well, you know you're talking to a good friend when you get off the tightrope, I'll say that. I mean, there were times when I would be at a cocktail party chatting with somebody, and I just thought, screw it. Like, I'm going to stop parsing every word, and I'm going to stop trying to say it in a way that they can hear it, and that's what, like, I'm just going to let it out. Like, I think, but you really have to trust that the person actually wants to hear what you have to say, and that they're not coming to you to feel better about their own mortality or the reality of mortality in general. Do you know what I mean? Like, not everybody actually wants to help you feel better. They're not. Sometimes people are asking because they're afraid themselves, because they know somebody at work, because their father's in chemo. And then you have to do it differently. You have to talk about it in a different way, and you have to take a different stance, and you have to be kind of a cancer ambassador. But every now and then someone asks you in a way that it's clear that they just want you to tell them whatever you want to tell them. They just want you to unburden yourself. And I could really feel the difference of that, where I wasn't being so selective about how I phrased things and what I emphasized and what I kind of hid from view. But, you know, I think that a lot of people who have been through a crisis, and there's many, obviously, many different kinds of crises that people communicate to their loved ones through email. And even a job search or something like that would qualify in my mind. And I think everyone can relate to this idea of not wanting to sound too desperate or too melodramatic, but also, you know, give people a sliver of what it actually feels like. And that's also the point of Circus of Cancer, actually, is there's a lot of essays on there about each leg of the race, so to speak. You know, first diagnosed, going into chemo, radiation, recurrence anxiety, that stuff. And that's really there to help people know this is what it actually feels like. So if you read this, then when you talk to your friend, you might be a little bit more comfortable with the whole thing, and you might have a little bit better sense of what it actually, what they're actually going through, and you can have a deeper, better conversation. You don't have to have this kind of 101 thing where you say, well, you sit in a chair, and this is a port, and they put it through an IV line, and first they start with this drug, and then they go to this drug, and they give you anti-nausea medication, and you generally fall asleep for an hour, and, you know, all the basics that eat up all your conversational time, and you never get to the good stuff, which is how you feel about it.
One of the things that is, of course, especially frightening is the thought that if you are not going to survive this, what that is going to mean for your two young daughters. And they were very young at the time that you were diagnosed. What were their ages specifically?
1 and 2.
You were thinking about people you knew who had lost their mothers very, very early in life, so early that they couldn't even remember their mothers. You write at one point, if my mom had died young, like Peggy Taylor in Sydney, I would not have a single memory of her. That's why I take so many pictures and keep old art projects and pull the video camera off the top of the fridge and turn it around on myself to report on the day's events. Today we're going back to the park to do the slide again. This is George's favorite book, The Remarkable Farkle, Miss McBride. These are the sparkly shoes Mommy bought for Claire, who calls them her click-clacks. I was here, girls, every day, helping you draw smiley faces in the condensation on the shower door, showing you how to hold scissors and twirl a pipe cleaner and play Keep It Up with a Party Balloon. This is my graffiti. This is me spray painting on every wall and etching in every headboard. I was here. How much could you allow yourself to think about that sort of awful possibility that you might not survive this and your daughters might have only a tenuous memory of who you were?
Well, you know, I was a nanny in Australia for a family whose mother had just died, and the kids were 4 and 7. And so I felt like I sort of knew what that was going to look like. You know, I mean, I was the first nanny on the scene after this woman had died of cancer. And so I had a really vivid sense of what a family looks like at that moment. And I knew that it would be, and I've always thought this, that it would be my loss and not theirs. Like those kids in Sydney, I mean, they're carrying whatever they're carrying, and I don't want to belittle whatever kind of hole in their heart they've got, but they went on. They were 4 and 7. It had been 3 or 4 months. They were fighting with each other all the time, going to swim parties, having friends over, going to the school play. You know, for every outside appearance, they were completely the same as they were a year before. And I know that since then, the guy shortly after got remarried and they merged families. And, you know, I've gotten letters and they're doing really well. And when I think about what would happen if I had a recurrence and I couldn't get it, the treatment didn't work, I think it would be, ultimately it would be my loss. Like, they would go on. Like, Edward would get remarried. Somebody would set him up with somebody. He's a great guy. There's tons of women that would love. I mean, you know, he would be. He's a great person to be married to. And the older people get, the more they're going to value that. And not the superficial stuff, you know. And, you know, and the, I mean, I just, I feel like that would be me that would, that would be my loss entirely, that I wouldn't get to watch, you know.
I am reminded of a really interesting moment in the, I think it's a film called Stepmom with Susan Sarandon and Julia Roberts. And to make a very complicated story short, Susan Sarandon is the biological mother who is dying of cancer. And Julia Roberts is the young woman that the husband took up with before all this cancer stuff came up. And Julia Roberts and Susan Sarandon eventually forge in kind of an uneasy relationship when it is clear that Susan Sarandon is not going to be able to live much longer. But at one point, Julia Roberts' character unburdens herself and says, you know, I am so scared. Do you realize what it feels like for me that, you know, someday when one of these daughters of yours gets married and I'm helping her put on her wedding dress and veil and she'll want her mom who won't be there. And Susan Sarandon's character says, and I'm afraid that she won't. I mean, she is owning up to that possibility that that there's also in those moments going to, you know, she will have gone on. Yeah, it really says a lot about what can possibly be pulled apart when something like cancer makes its unwelcome appearance.
Yeah.
In the midst of all of this, what makes it an even more interesting, complicated story is that your father begins his own multi-chapter battle with cancer. One of the toughest things that you face is how much to, in a sense, intrude on his struggle. And in particular, the fact that you felt, in a sense, that because you yourself were contending with cancer, this gave you, in a sense, sort of a level of authority and a right to be a part of his story. And he did not seem at all interested in pursuing this fight in the way that you would have. Talk for a moment of about that really difficult quandary that you found yourself in addition to just on a personal level, how frightening this all was for you.
Well, I mean, it's totally tied, right? I mean, when mortality's in the room, you better give people something to do. So if you're going to call and tell me that my father is dying, you better give me something to do, or I'm going to just crawl the walls, and I'm going to make a complete nuisance out of myself, and I'm going to do all the wrong things. This is why you got to let people cook for you and take your kids to school and stuff, because they're all going crazy inside. And so there was that, which was just, you know, I just had way too much emotional energy, and I needed work. And I wasn't able to do very much because I was in California, and I couldn't leave California because I had to stay on my radiation schedule. And then there's just the generational difference of the way people in that generation deal with stuff and the way we do. I mean, you know, I wrote this long essay for O Magazine where I contribute, and the poll quote that they made really large was, they gave it to God and we gave it to Google. And it sort of sums it up, you know. We got off the phone from my diagnosis and went to the Internet, and my parents got off the phone and went to church. And that's great, and I don't think that they're wrong. I just wish that they had done both. You know, I just wanted them to get second opinions. I wanted them to ask the questions. I wanted them to take notes in the meetings. You know, I wanted them to attack it like a project, and not accept it like a fate. So there's that. And then, you know, I'm one of three. So my brothers were, you know, we were all stepping all over each other trying to figure out. And you know, seeing how your siblings deal with this moment is really interesting because it's never the same. And everybody has a right to do it the way they need to do it because everybody's having both an emotional experience and an intellectual experience at the same time.
Now, you've already touched on how in many ways, this was an extraordinary experience for you and your your husband to make this journey of cancer together. I mean, that in many ways it drew you closer and made ultimately a great difference for the better in your relationship, which was already very strong to begin with. What about your father? Do you feel like his journey through cancer, and to whatever extent you found yourself desperately wanting to share that journey with him, do you find that that relationship was very powerfully altered, or maybe not so much?
It wasn't. I mean, he's so consistently him. I don't think he is alterable. I mean, he's the same guy he was when he was 5 years old. And I know this because I recently went to this special dinner for him because he went into the Lacrosse Hall of Fame, which in our family is like winning the Nobel Prize. And all his brothers and sisters came because they always do. They always rally for whomever needs it or deserves it. And they all made these toasts, and 5 out of 5 of them stood up, cried, said, "You're my best friend. You're the nuttiest person I know. You haven't changed a whip since you were a kid." And I remember sitting there thinking, like, oh, thank God I didn't make it up. Because I'm so far away, and I do have a romantic disposition, and I am into stories, and my mind does sort of shape things in a way, and I'm aware of this, even if I can't stop it. And I felt like I got this right? And I showed my brothers, and they were like, right, this is right. And then, you know, some friends, and they were like, that's exactly how I experience your father. And then I was sitting in that room, and the book had been locked at that point. It hadn't been released. It was totally, the manuscript was in production, much too late to do anything about it. And I just had this overwhelming feeling of calm, like, you know what? That's exactly who he is. He is absolutely 100% accurately represented in that book. It's just who he is. I did not blow him up. I did not make more of him than there is.
And he is still here. Correct.
Still here. He's still. I just was with him for 10 days. We brought the girls back, and we hung with my mom and dad. And I ran around and did readings on the East Coast. And those guys, my parents and my kids are so happy together. It's crazy.
There is so much in the pages of this book. Lots of very profound observations about pain and fear, and what it feels like to give comfort and help, and what it feels like to receive it, for that matter. And, of course, about living with uncertainty and of surviving awful things and emerging out on the other side stronger for it. It's a wonderful, wonderful book called The Middle Place. It is published by Voice, which is a division of Hyperion, and the author, Kelly Corrigan. Kelly Corrigan, I so appreciate the pleasure and privilege I had in reading this book and in talking with you about it. And I thank you so much, and well, wish you good health and happiness in the years ahead.
Thank you so much. You're a wonderful interviewer. And if anybody wants to read excerpts or watch videos or whatever, it's all on kellycorrigan.com.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I'm excited to share with you an interview with Ross Bennis, author of Rural Rebellion. Ross Bennis grew up in a tiny town in Nebraska, Brainerd, Nebraska, with a high school graduating class of about 40. He now lives and works and writes in New York City, and he has experienced, in a way that a lot of us have not, the sharp urban-rural divide in America. And that is what he writes about in his fascinating new book. On Thursday's morning show, I am happy to be speaking with a faculty colleague from Carthage, Dr. Anthony Barnhart, who is chair of the Psychological Sciences Department at Carthage. He is on the program, actually, to, in a sense, respond to and maybe offer a rebuttal to a recent conversation that aired on the program about handwriting. And he took exception to some of the extraordinary claims made by that morning show guest and some of what she says in her book. And so I gave Professor Barnhart a chance to, in a sense, speak his piece and respond. And we recorded an interview that I'm excited to share with you on Thursday's morning show. On Friday, a look at the difficulties of small-town Americans securing high-quality health care. I'll be speaking with Brian Alexander, the author of a powerful new book, which is called The Hospital. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. It is exactly 9.